Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is The Guardian.
To have two states living in security, in stability, in peace alongside one another, they are the ultimate objectives. Not having some Palestinian state sitting at a table at the United Nations. It's about having Palestinian peoples living in peace with a chance of prosperity alongside the Israeli peoples. And that's the outcome everybody should prioritise.
Hi, I'm Karen Middleton, Guardian Australia's political editor, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. Today on the Australian Politics Podcast, I'm speaking with Senator Simon Birmingham, the Coalition's spokesperson on foreign affairs and the leading moderate in the Federal Parliamentary Liberal Party. This week, Foreign Minister Penny Wong gave a speech calling for faster progress towards Palestinian statehood. The opposition was highly critical, both of what she said and of the timing. And its leader, Peter Dutton, gave a speech of his own, accusing the government of allowing anti-Semitism to flourish in Australia and prompting questions about whether bipartisanship on foreign affairs is now officially consigned to history. I'll ask Senator Birmingham about all of this and his post-election call for the Liberals to return to the middle ground. Where's that up to exactly? Senator, thanks for joining me.
Great to be with you.
Let's start with the big issue of the week. It seems to be the big issue of every week, but we're really focused again on the Israel-Gaza conflict and particularly the comments from Foreign Minister Penny Wong this week about Palestinian statehood and progress towards that. Now, you are still talking about a two-state solution. So can we clarify just from the outset here, you do still advocate for a two-state solution. Am I right about that?
We stand absolutely by what is a long-term, decades-old bipartisan consensus in Australia in support of a negotiated two-state solution, one where the parties have successfully negotiated terms, borders, security, and, of course, guaranteeing within that security respect for each other's right to exist. And so our position there hasn't changed. What appears to be the case is that Penny Wong's speech is elevating the prospects of some type of earlier, potentially unilateral recognition of a state of Palestine absent an actual two-state solution, which would be a significant deviation from that decades-long bipartisan consensus in Australian policy.
And it is that timing that you've raised in particular, both the timing of the introduction of a Palestinian state and the timing of her comments. Let's go to the first part of that. My understanding is there are international discussions about sort of moving this up the list of priorities, I guess, which is going to what you just said. We've previously thought that the Palestinian state would be a sort of an end of negotiations position. And it looks now like it's not the first thing. Obviously, the first thing has to be the relinquishment of the hostages and then the end of firing at the same time. But it looks like it's now moved up the list and somewhere on the pathway to ending this conflict rather than after the conflict ends. So what you're saying, are you, that you think that that would be a one-sided arrangement? Is that your concern about moving it up rather than having it at the end?
It would be a potentially one-sided arrangement and also a potentially dysfunctional arrangement if you haven't actually got a negotiated two-state solution, but instead just some arbitrary or unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state with a whole range of issues left completely unresolved. And there is a necessary and logical sequence to how this very, very difficult challenge is overcome. And it requires, firstly, security and stabilisation. And in the current environment, that feels so very, very far away and is, of course, dependent first and foremost, as you said, upon the release of the hostages by Hamas and the removal of the terrorist capabilities of Hamas and the threat that they pose. But then, of course, there is a need for true stabilisation within Gaza and the establishment of some type of governance framework that people can have confidence in, including confidence around the security that it poses and a true demilitarisation of the Palestinian territories so that there is that complete confidence around the security undertakings that could be given. And only through that type of situation can we then build the confidence that can enable true negotiations to happen between Israel and representatives of the Palestinian people to try to overcome the many, many challenges that are there. And of course, this has been tried many times before, proven to be incredibly difficult or challenging. Now we're in a situation of such deep and horrific conflict, bloodshed and loss of life. We all wish to see that come to an end. We wish to see that come to an end with Hamas removed and hostages freed. And if those steps can be taken, we hope then that the type of stabilisation and international engagement required to underpin that could happen to perhaps allow the parties involved to take those steps through that type of sequence that I just outlined.
And you've also said it a number of times in the past when you've talked about a two-state solution, I think you've said words to the effect of, or some other lasting settlement or some other negotiated settlement. Does that leave room for an alternative to Palestinian statehood? And what is that alternative? What are you thinking when you talk about another kind of settlement?
Karen, I think we have to be realistic and open-minded about how the parties may approach this. Now, here from Australia, a long way away, we're not going to be leading nor central to those discussions. But if you look at the types of frustrations that former President Bill Clinton has expressed about the lengths he went to try to achieve a two-state solution and a Palestinian state, guaranteeing all of Gaza, as he says, 97-98% of West Bank, but still not being able to resolve other issues and get Palestinian agreement to those terms. You've had people like Henry Kissinger before his death talk about it as being an unviable proposition, unlikely to be achieved. Now, they have variously, Kissinger and other thinkers in this space, mused about possibilities around potential Jordanian control of Gaza or around the possibility for a demilitarized Palestinian entity to work within the state of Israel. There are different things that different scholars, different policy thinkers have suggested over time. That's not to say that any of them are likely. Our position remains support for the negotiated two-state solution that has been on the table for a long time, and that is where most international discussion lies and is therefore most likely to have international momentum. But after something as incredibly horrific and disruptive as the Hamas-instigated war that has raged for the last 6 months, I don't think anybody could discount the possibility that if you could reach the point of negotiations, perhaps there are other pathways that could achieve the type of stabilisation and recognition of the legitimate rights and aspirations for peace and security of both Israelis and Palestinians.
Given Palestinians' ambition, though, which has long been stated as a Palestinian state, they are not going to accept what they would see as a compromise, are they?
Karen, as I said, it takes negotiation, it takes two parties, but also we have to recognise that the efforts of Clinton and others to get to a two-state solution have faltered, and they've faltered for a range of particularly significant issues, such as issues around the intergenerational right to return question that gets raised in these matters, and they're the ones that have to be overcome for any type of stabilisation and long-term settlement. Now, it may be that some of the ideas mused by Kissinger or other thinkers provide interim steps towards a final two-state solution. They're all hypotheticals. They'll all be the subject, no doubt, of intense negotiations. Right now, the negotiations happening in Cairo are about whether or not a ceasefire can be achieved. And it's notable that the US has highlighted the lack of cooperation from Hamas there and their unwillingness to make commitments about hostage release that are necessary for a ceasefire. And that just shows that the continued challenge and tragedy of trying to get even the smallest breakthroughs in what should be the most obvious step taken to try to end the current bloodshed.
Given the seeming impossibility, as you say, and we just seem to go around and round and we never quite get to the conditions for that final agreement, is that not an argument for moving it up the list of priorities, or you don't think that's a reason to try and put it on the table earlier?
The risk is that you create a situation that embeds all of the other problems because statehood has been given. And so the inability then to settle and secure negotiations around borders, the inability to settle questions around rights of return, the inability to settle fundamental questions around security and demilitarisation of appropriate zones to give confidence to that security. And so just waving out a two-state solution, or particularly unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state without resolving those other issues, runs the very real risk that you actually entrench the inability to resolve those issues even further and make it even harder to get the tangible things done that are essential to not just have two states, but to have two states living in security, in stability, in peace alongside one another. And they are the ultimate objectives. Not having some Palestinian state sitting at a table at the United Nations. It's about having Palestinian peoples living in peace with a chance of prosperity alongside the Israeli peoples. And that's the outcome everybody should prioritise.
And would Israel have to agree to not have a role in security in Gaza or in a Palestinian state for that to be a viable agreement?
Karen, that goes to the type of negotiations I just said before and the type of security undertakings you would have to expect from one to another. And Israel would no doubt be looking for confidence that they would have a demilitarised neighbour there, that given the experience, particularly most recently on October 7, of seeing hordes of Hamas fighters swarm across the Gaza border and kill more Jews on a single day since the Holocaust, you can understand that demilitarising and disarming that region would be a precondition for Israel. Obviously, if that could be met, secured, then clearly there would be expectations from the Palestinian peoples about how Israel's security forces would operate and where they could or couldn't operate. But you know, they are all what requires getting parties to the negotiating table, not providing endpoint outcomes that could dissuade them from making those important steps in negotiations.
Senator, your party leader, Peter Dutton, in a speech earlier this week, suggested that what Penny Wong had raised about Palestinian statehood this week would irreparably damage relations with Israel. Given that other countries have leant forward as well, and I'm thinking particularly of her British counterpart, David Cameron, in similar ways, how exactly do you think the raising of this here in Australia is going to irreparably damage Australia's relations with Israel, or damage them more than, say, Britain's relations with Israel?
Karen, the remarks made this week were unnecessary and poorly timed, and they will have damaging effects in the relationship because they were unnecessary and poorly timed, as well as, I would argue from our previous conversation, poorly thought out if it is an indication of the government proceeding to some type of fast-tracked early or unilateral recognition of a state of Palestine. So in terms of the timing of them, for them to be made in the midst of the Cairo negotiations, when, for example, US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was urging parties to focus on putting pressure on Hamas to make agreements to release hostages that could enable a ceasefire, instead of that being the focus of commentary from this side of the world, instead we have commentary about a potential earlier recognition of a state of Palestine. That's not helping the immediate priority, and Israel would no doubt see that as counterproductive to trying to achieve that hostage release and those ceasefire negotiations. It's also not necessary. If you look at the timing of, for example, David Cameron's comments, it was off the back of when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been asked and made comments, and David Cameron was asked in response to that. Penny Wong has chosen to elevate this at a matter of her own timing in a keynote speech extensively briefed out. For what purpose? What is the purpose of her elevating this in the Australian context at this time? And that is where it creates damage, I think, in terms of whether politics are being played with it or what the actual intent and purpose of it is.
There may be at least a partial answer to that in the fact that the United Nations General Assembly looks like it's going to end up debating and possibly voting on a motion in support of Palestinian statehood that's being put firstly to the Security Council, and that may even occur within the month. Now, even if the Security Council members veto it, such a vote could still go ahead in the General Assembly along with a debate. That would put Australia in a position where it has to nominate whether it's going to support that motion or not. So does it affect your criticisms of the timing that there may have at least been that consideration that sooner or later, probably within weeks, Australia's going to have to set a position, and this is sort of laying the groundwork for that?
Well, Karen, that then drives to the need for the government to clarify what the intent and reasoning behind the speech and the remarks were. Because we'd had on Tuesday night, if my recollection of the week is correct, Penny Wong giving the speech extensively briefed out, seemingly elevating the prospect of a unilateral recognition of Palestinian statehood. On Wednesday, we had the Prime Minister desperately, clearly giving statements saying there has been no change to Australia's policy or position. So, which is it? If this is a warming up, a limbering up for a change in position at the United Nations, then the government should be transparent and perhaps undertaking consultations with the affected communities. Our position is clear. We don't think that would be helpful. It is not our policy. We stand by the decades-long bipartisan position around a negotiated two-state solution. But if the Albanese government is seeking to take the steps towards a unilateral recognition, then rather than flying a kite while simultaneously denying that's their policy position, they ought to be transparent and actually sit down and engage with interested parties in Australia and go through a proper process. Right now, it's just a government that has created confusion within Australia and angst from abroad.
Your reference to the sequence there prompts me to remind those listening to us that, of course, we're talking about an issue that is a fast-moving issue, and this is being recorded, a conversation on Thursday. People won't hear it until at least Saturday, so there may well be changes in the interim. We just remind people of that. But, you know, to your point and about the United Nations, are you saying Australia should vote no if that gets to a vote, even though it's not likely to be a legally binding vote if it is a UN General Assembly vote after a veto applied? And there's a lot of hypotheticals in there, but we will have to make a decision. Do you think Australia should say no then?
If it is a motion that provides for a unilateral recognition of Palestinian statehood in some form, that's inconsistent with the long-standing position of Australia. It would be counterproductive to providing for the incentive and the momentum following this conflict to negotiate the many unresolved issues around borders, around security, around return rights and other matters. And so Australia should stick with our long-standing position, which would be to oppose that. Of course, the text of any motion matters, but if the proposition is a simple one for some type of unilateral recognition at this time, then that's inconsistent with where Australia has been or should be.
There are many other foreign policy issues that we can talk about, and I do want to ask you about a couple. But before we leave this one, the appointment of former Air Chief Marshal Mark Binskin as an advisor to the Australian government to look at the investigation Israel's conducting into the deaths of the seven aid workers, including Australian Zomi Frankum. You raised concerns about that. I think you said it was political. I'm not sure why you thought it was political. Can you explain that?
Well, Mark Binskin is beyond reproach and is a highly respected and regarded individual. And he has been given a task, though, that depending upon how it is interpreted, can be seen as political, impossible, or certainly with high degrees of difficulty. What happened with Zomi Frankum was a tragedy, and it shouldn't have occurred. And Israel has been right to acknowledge that it shouldn't have occurred, to apologise for it, and to instigate investigations. And Australia is right to expect those investigations and to expect transparency around them. If Mark Binscombe is simply providing advice within government, the Australian government, to understand the steps and processes, then there may be some merit of value in that. But if there is an expectation that somehow his role is going to see different processes or practices applied in another country to what their legal frameworks may entail, then that is setting him up for failure and misleading Australians in terms of what is a realistic expectation here. Now, Israel does have legal processes. Those legal processes could see charges laid. They have seen already within the military individuals stood aside from their roles. That's a far higher level of responsiveness and transparency than, of course, occurred when Australian Gilad Cabone was killed by Hamas, who say they would repeat those atrocities rather than apologise for them. But you know, we should continue to work through with Israel in their processes very carefully.
My understanding of his role from talking to people about that is it's sort of not either of those options completely. It is advising the Australian government and it is asking questions of Israel and asking for access to the evidence and to understand the processes involved, but not doing a shadow investigation and certainly not suggesting any third country investigation at all. And my understanding is that a part of the thinking of putting someone like him in is that he's a former chief of the Defence Force, so he has a high status. He may have to deal with the Israeli Defence Force, so that is, you know, defence military person to military person. He's also from the Air Force, so he understands in practical ways, not only the legal considerations around targeting in a conflict environment, but also the practicalities of having to make those split-second decisions. So he's not sort of, not to diminish lawyers in any way, but he's not just a lawyer, either a military lawyer or a human rights lawyer. In fact, I think he's not a lawyer at all, but will have legal support. Do those things alleviate your concerns at all, that he's not seeking to run a shadow investigation? He's quite carefully not doing that. And that he is a person who perhaps has standing in a conversation like this. Does that make you any happier about his appointment?
If you had to have the position, Mark Binscombe is the perfect type of person for the position. The question really is, what does the Albanese government expect of the position and for it to yield? And what impressions or expectations do they raise in the Australian community about what role that position is going to be able to take and to achieve? Now, we will obviously, as I said, want to see Israeli investigations concluded thoroughly and transparently. But the extent to which any Australian official will have access to all of the intelligence or information is one where we should reflect in reverse in terms of our own defence forces, our own investigations and procedures and processes, how much we would open them up, even to a friend or ally, if the situation were reversed. We have our processes, we have our procedures. We've demonstrated that in response to issues raised in Afghanistan, although not with charges having been laid at this point in time either. So let's understand that, in terms of military conflict, there are a range of different judgments that no doubt somebody like Mark Binscombe understands and understands very carefully, but they are also carefully handled as each nation wants to ensure that its serving personnel have the appropriate protections and safety in relation to their ability to do their job in defence of their own country.
That sounds a little bit like be careful what you wish for because we might invite other countries to poke around in our backyard. Is that the point you're making there?
I'm not quite seeking to make that point, and I don't imagine that Israel would be seeking or have any reason or interest to do so with Australia. But I think it is reasonable to always reflect upon the protections we expect to be applied to our defence personnel, the standards and the way in which they operate. And as the debate has ensued, this was a tragedy and it shouldn't have happened. And we would all expect Israel not only to be transparent in its investigations, but to be taking steps to ensure such a tragedy is not repeated again. But that doesn't negate the fact that innocent people tragically do get killed in war, that mistakes do happen. And it's naive to argue or suggest otherwise, as much as our expectations should be on any party to take all steps consistent with international law to avoid that from occurring.
We could talk much more about this subject, of course, but I'll move us along. I want to ask you about the state of relations with China. We saw an important visit recently from Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. We then saw a reversing of the situation with tariff concerns about wine. And so it looks like things are moving in the right direction economically, certainly on that subject. But I wonder, firstly, what you think of where relations are at the moment. And secondly, are we getting to a point where this is a transactional relationship? Can we avoid it being that? I did put that question to Penny Wong on this podcast last week, and I'm interested in your view about that. Is there a way of avoiding, given the tensions that exist in the security domain, but we're trying to be friends economically and find common ground, are we destined to just make this a transactional relationship where they give us something, then we have to give them something?
Firstly, Australia should always, as a country, through our foreign policy and our other policy instruments, we should work to defend our values and pursue our interests. And we've got to be clear in all of that. And sometimes the defence of our values may be at the expense of certain short-term interests, but by defending our values, it will always be in our long-term interests in terms of standing up for our country and the things that make our democracy and our freedoms so critical and so valuable for us. The relationship with China is clearly a crucial one. They are the most populous nation within our immediate region, the largest economy within our immediate region, and that means that our interests are permanently tied as a function of geography. They are also significantly tied as a function of economy and the steps that we've taken through complementary economic circumstances to be able to grow each other's economy. And as I've said many times, particularly in my days as Trade Minister, China's growth and the growth that it drove across Southeast Asia was one of the economic miracles of our lifetimes that's lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And we should all be very happy for the work that began under Deng Xiaoping with opening and reform and pursued that. But China today is a different one. And under Xi Jinping, that initial agenda of opening and reform can be seen with greater ambitions now by China to be able to exert significant influence through global and world bodies and agencies, as well as within our region. And within that influence comes aspirations in parts for control of certain shipping channels, of certain places that impact directly upon Australia. We have to, in defence of our values and of our interests, remain clear in how we stand up to those sorts of pressures. But I welcome the fact that, seemingly under the last couple of years, China has reversed from its attempted economic coercion on Australia. It has eased aspects of its wolf warrior diplomacy, and it has enabled a stabilisation of relations. And that is a good thing, because for the stability of our region, we should seek to build deterrence from conflict that can enable diplomacy to do its work. And that is precisely what we as a coalition want to see: strong investment in defence, in deterrence capabilities and partnerships that can ensure there is sufficient deterrence and sufficient space for diplomacy to avoid conflict and to keep our region free, open and prosperous. Now, to the last point of your question, because it is a lot in this space, does it become a transactional relationship? Well, on one level, you can argue that nearly all but the most deep relationships are somewhat transactional. And again, to reflect on my days as Trade Minister, the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement or the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership between Australia and China, both signed under the previous coalition government, were big steps in our relationship. But there's still negotiations about parties agree to do this, they'll take certain steps, they'll sequence them at certain times. They are transactional in a way. And so that is always there to some degree in terms of the way in which relationships operate. But having made those commitments, our expectation is that just as Australia fulfills the spirit and letter of something like the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement, so too should China. It hasn't been doing that. It's been an obvious breach of it. If we can get back to a point where our peoples, Our businesses between our two nations can strengthen their ties and engagement under those negotiated terms, then that can only help to improve at least understanding even where differences continue between our governments.
I want to take you, you raised values, I want to take you to the question of values, and I'm interested in the context of the speech I mentioned that Peter Dutton gave earlier in the week at the Opera House, the Tom Hughes Oration, which is a Liberal Party speech, and he took the opportunity to really make, I think it was aiming at a domestic audience, but there was a lot that touched on foreign policy in that speech. And it does make me wonder whether, you know, we've long said that we have bipartisanship in foreign policy, but that was a very political speech accusing the government and indeed law enforcement of failing the nation by allowing anti-Semitism to spread. And it was effectively using the issue of the Gaza conflict and the knock-on effects, which have been terrible, to make a political point in Australia. And I wonder, is it fair game now to use foreign policy stuff for domestic political advantage or gain? Is that a new thing, or do you think we've abandoned that old protocol a long time ago?
I think we always have to be careful about how much we romanticise over the past. Yes, we have and we pursue bipartisan foreign policy where we can, where it is in Australia's interest to do so. We are certainly stronger when we can speak as one on the world stage, but that doesn't mean that our parties of government always agree, and nor have they always agreed. You can look back to the Labor Party under Simon Crean and the decisions in relation to the Iraq War at the time, which was a significant deviation of position between the two parties of government. You can go back to debates around the Vietnam War, or you can go back to even some other earliest days and debates around issues such as conscription and how that would have been perceived in terms of our commitment or ability to support empire at the time. So I think we should be clear. There have been and probably always will be certain points of difference. It's about how we ensure that when it really matters in the national interest, we put those differences aside to be able to pursue areas of common interest and build upon the work of one another. And whilst there have been plenty of politics played, particularly in the last election campaign, around the issue of relations with Pacific Island nations, I'd actually argue that in the main, what governments are doing at present is building one upon the other, that aspects of the Pacific step up pursued by the previous government are actually now being built upon by this government, as you would expect a future government to build on them further, and that is where the continuity of Australian foreign policy is important in some of those areas.
I'd love to ask you about the Pacific, but I'm going to run out of time, and I just want to stick with this issue about Mr. Dutton's speech and particularly some comments he made about immigration, and it does touch on your portfolio too because it goes to the legislation the government was trying to get through the parliament recently. And Peter Dutton said that under a coalition government, and I'll quote him, non-citizens who incite or choose violence should have their visas cancelled and be deported, unquote. But it strikes me, isn't that the whole problem that the government is grappling with at the moment with that piece of legislation it was trying to get through Parliament, which is that people won't cooperate with deportation and countries won't take them back? And in fact, you know, there are aspects of that that involve sort of effectively punishing countries by refusing to issue any kinds of visas until they take them back. So wouldn't you need exactly the same kind of legislation that the government is proposing to action what Peter Dutton said he wants? And isn't that the legislation that you've refused to pass so far?
Well, Karen, I think a couple of things there. Under Peter Dutton, as Home Affairs Minister at the time, significant decisions were taken that saw an increase in visa cancellations and an increase in deportations. You're right. Many people try to not cooperate with that deportation agenda, but nonetheless, there was a very successful and significant step up in relation to visa cancellations and deportations of individuals who had breached visa conditions or had no right to be in Australia. And I think Australians can have confidence that Peter Dutton is committed and genuine in relation to his stance and his approach on those issues. To the powers the government proposed to achieve and the legislation, we haven't made a position as a coalition in relation to that legislation. What we did do when confronted with it on the second to last day of the last parliamentary sitting week and asked by the government to pass it within a 24 to 36 hour period was we called Home Affairs officials before parliamentary committee for a quick couple of hours worth of hearings to quiz them on that, to try to understand the urgency and how those powers would be used. And then we considered whether it was necessary to wave them through in a very speedy process or to actually have a proper inquiry and to assess whether they could be improved upon, whether they would achieve the objectives the government says and how that applies. And that's the process that's underway. And I think reasoning and approach there was a considered one. And it should also be seen in the context of the two previous pieces of border protection legislation the Labor government had brought forward. The first one in relation to electronic monitoring of individuals released from detention. The second one in relation to the seeking of protection orders, community protection orders from individuals released. And in those cases, the government argued the urgency of passage for them. What we've learned since is that many individuals are not subject to electronic monitoring and no community protection orders have been sought. So to suggest that perhaps we might take a few weeks to consider this bill when the government could not persuade us or, of course, the Greens or any of the crossbench about the urgency of passing it was not an unreasonable approach.
I just want to finish briefly on domestic politics. You're the senior Liberal moderate in the parliament, and I think after the election you suggested the coalition needed to move to the middle. I'd just like an update from you 2 years in. Have you moved to the middle, do you think?
I'm not sure I ever used that phrase, but I certainly identified issues that that I thought we lost votes on and how we perceived and concerns around those. And I think there is work in progress in relation to how they are addressed. I'd wish to see a faster, stronger response of the party organisation and pre-selectors in terms of how we get good, strong, diverse candidates into the parliament. I hope that we can see that pick up over time. It's not something that that happens overnight. It is an area where clearly there is more work to be had. I think you can see in a policy lens that the debate Peter Dutton is having about consideration of an issue such as nuclear power in Australia, it shows a willingness to take a very hard policy issue, previously third rail issue in Australian politics, and put it on the table as a demonstration of how seriously we're willing to now look at what is necessary to not only commit to net zero by 2050, but to have confidence that it can be achieved and achieved within sensible economic parameters. And so those things, I think, show that there is progress in the policy scape. Obviously, people will judge the totality of that progress come the next election and see just how fulsomely some of those issues have been addressed, along with other really critical ones in terms of appeal to younger voters around matters of home ownership, for example.
Just briefly and finally, I think the point I was really making was that a lot of moderate Liberals are looking at the policy landscape and the rhetoric from the coalition and not seeing their views reflected, seeing that it is still leaning fairly hard to the Conservative end. And in your own home state of South Australia, we saw Alex Antic pre-selected ahead of Anne Rustin, who was ostensibly a much more senior figure. So what do you say to moderate Liberal voters who are looking to you and your moderate colleagues to defend their kinds of Liberal views against what they see as a push towards conservatism and the views that might differ from Peter Dutton's and the Conservative end? What do you say to them to assure them that they are being forcefully represented in the Liberal Party?
Well, Karen, a couple of things. One is that when it comes to the policy landscape and issues like the commitment to net zero, to know that I and other colleagues are working hard to ensure strong, sensible commitments and policies to underpin those commitments in relation to such issues. But the other, which is a message that I guess can be given anywhere, but I'll take the chance for a free hit on the Guardian podcast, is that if you care enough, get involved and help to shape and influence, because the Liberal Party is a democratic structure. It's one built from grassroots membership up, and for people to change the direction of the party or shape the direction of the party, they need to get involved and help to do so. And if people have those concerns, then I certainly would welcome them and encourage their participation.
Thank you for being here on Guardian Australia's Australian Politics podcast. We're very grateful for your time, so thanks again.
Thank you, Karen. My pleasure.
This episode was produced by Alison Chan. The executive producer is Molly Glassie. Thanks for listening. See you next time.